I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. From filibusters and threats to shut down the government to outsider presidential candidates and vows to block Syrian refugees, the Republican Party is in a peculiar place, some say an unprecedented place. Is the GOP too polarized to be functional? In this hour of Midday, an historical look at political insurgencies from the past, from the Democratic Watergate babies of the 70s to the Tea Party and the Freedom Caucus today. Columnist Barry Raskovar, Laura Blessing of Georgetown University, and author Jeffrey Cabaservis join us to discuss the polarization of American politics on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad that you're with us today. We're going to talk politics today and try to take the long view. If I were to ask you which 20th century U.S. president transformed the military to an all-volunteer force, responded to concerns about pollution and conservation by creating the Environmental Protection Agency, and dedicated $100 million to cancer research and treatment centers around the country, you would probably search your memory of Democrats in the Oval Office, right? And you might have a hard time seeing these as the top domestic policy achievements of Republican President Richard Nixon. Nowadays, it is unlikely we'd see a candidate like Nixon rise in the ranks of the Republican Party. Likewise, the polarization we've seen in American politics in recent years makes it more likely that Dwight Eisenhower and even Ronald Reagan would have more success today running as Democrats than in the GOP. There, of course, has also been polarization on the other side of the aisle. The Democratic field has a big place for a candidate who identifies himself as a Democratic socialist, Bernie Sanders. But today we're going to focus on the party of Lincoln, the party of Teddy Roosevelt. What is going on in the Republican Party and where is it leading? And we're counting on your comments and questions, so get ready to join us. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can call long distance. 866-661-9309 is our toll-free line. Or, of course, you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Joining me in our studio here in Baltimore to discuss the current state of the Republican Party is Laura Blessing, senior fellow in the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University in Washington. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also here in Baltimore is Barry Raskovar, columnist for MarylandReporter.com. Welcome back to the show, Barry.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone from Alexandria, Virginia, is Jeffrey Cabaservis. He's author of From Rule to Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me here.
So I think probably the best way for us to start is for me to ask each of you, Laura, I'll start with you, what is going on in the Republican Party? What do you think is the most important thing we should be looking at right now?
Sure. I mean, it's not unusual to have meaningful intra-party divisions, and we certainly have some very meaningful intra-party divisions within the Republican Party right now. The Freedom Caucus, a very strong Tea Party base, was formalized this January, and they're roughly, nearly 40 members, prevents the Speaker of the House from getting to that magic number of 218. And so they've been pretty influential in a number of different episodes, particularly the 2013 government shutdown, although they weren't formally the Freedom Caucus then, debt ceiling issues, and they're asking, like most groups within a party that feels like they don't have enough voice, they're asking for greater voice. So we're hearing a lot of calls for more regular order, more voices to be allowed into the Republican Party and allowed in governance. And this is something that Speaker Paul D. Ryan is going to have to wrestle with going forward.
Okay. Jeffrey Cabaservis, what would you put on the table as what we ought to be focusing on and understanding what's going on in the Republican Party?
Well, I think something to consider is that the Republican Party, in some ways, is doing better than it has in decades. The last election brought in more Republican members of the House than any election since 1928. So on the one hand, I think you need to consider that the problems the party is having right now are the problems of success. Given that they aren't in the minority, a lot of people feel that they no longer have to buckle down to the will of the majority leader, and that now is their time to sort of speak out and get what they can. But unfortunately, some of the difficulties that you see in the House, such as Boehner's in effect ouster, the veto in effect of his designated successor, Kevin McCarthy, and generally speaking, the extremes to which the House Freedom Caucus is trying to push the party, these do damage the party at the national level. And the problems that you've seen in the presidential nomination process so far suggest that the GOP is not making good on what was called the autopsy document after the 2012 presidential election. The Republican National Committee had sought to have the party orient itself towards voters who typically don't vote Republican, minorities, younger people, to some extent people in who are gays and lesbians, and it doesn't seem that the party is moving in that direction after all. So to some extent, the party's good fortune on the level of the Congress is causing it difficulties at the presidential level.
And I want to pick up some of those in a bit, but let me ask Barry Raskovar the same question. What do you think is the overarching most important thing for us to be focusing on when we talk about what's going on in the Republican Party these days?
Yeah, I think the most important question is whether the Republican Party is in the process of imploding, whether after the 2016 presidential election, the party will be so shattered that you may end up with a third political party. You have to go back to the establishment of the Republican Party, which came out of the shards of the Whig Party, the Know-Nothings, and the Free Soilers. So, you know, it's happened before that parties have splintered and new entities have arisen, and it could well be that the Tea Party, Freedom Party movement is going to move the GOP so far to the right that the more moderate conservatives can't tolerate it anymore. And somebody's going to leave the party and try to recreate what they think is a more pragmatic Republican party. So I think that's... To me, that's the central issue at the moment.
Well, I confess I've had the same thought, but I have to, Laura, hold that thought. I want to throw it back to Jeffrey Cabot-Service. So you're saying at one level, at the congressional level, the Republican Party is seeing great success, and then here comes Barry Raskovar saying maybe it's about to implode. Make sense of that for me.
Well, you know, it is the fact that the Republican Party does have great success, and probably thanks to the benefits of redistricting, it will continue to control at least the House, maybe also the Senate, possibly through 2020. So it's hard to say that this is a party that seems in imminent danger of imploding. On the other hand, there certainly is a struggle between the factions in Congress, which are best epitomized by the House Freedom Caucus at the far right, the Republican Study Committee, which I would say is the generally conservative group in the middle, and then the group for which I'm a research consultant, which is the Main Street Partnership, and this is a group of 70 members of Congress who represent the more moderate wing of the party. And there's a lot of contention among these for who represents the Republican Party and the direction in which it should go moving forward. And what I think may well happen is that if the Republicans lose the presidential contest in 2016 for the third time in a row, this would actually force a real reevaluation of the direction the party is heading in, and I think would pull it back more towards the center where the majority of the American people are. And that could provoke an exodus from the far right, but it's too soon to tell.
Laura, you were going to say.
Sure. If I can kind of stake out a position that's at least rhetorically between the two other people, although I will concede the point that on downstream races, Republicans are doing extraordinarily well, particularly if you look at the state level, and agree with Cabot-Service there, and agree with Raskovar in that the presidential aspirations look fairly long off for the Republicans for the foreseeable future. I'd like to interject just the idea that it's increasingly hard for the Republican Party to control its members in Congress, and this is the trend of weak and weaker parties is certainly true for both parties. We've had candidate-centered elections for a very long time, but there are a number of very recent developments that I think we should pay attention to that makes it hard for parties to really, you know, be held accountable for their own members. You know, whether it's the earmarks ban since 2010 that, you know, reduces the number of carrots they have, more and more funding in a post-Citizens United world comes from outside groups. 2014 was the most ever.
So it's not the party that is actually funneling money to candidates.
Less and less over time.
Okay.
Being primaried is a fairly recent phenomena, actually, of just the past couple of cycles. And it's harder to punish people institutionally in Congress. And we've seen this with different Freedom Caucus members, whether it's Mark Meadows. They tried to punish him by taking away a subcommittee chair. They gave it back. Boehner's out of Congress. He's still there.
Meadow is still there.
Correct.
I thought you were telling me that Boehner was lurking around someplace that I'd missed.
No. I think he's enjoying himself from Capitol Hill.
I'm sure he is.
Sheila, there's another element that has been added to the mix in the last 6 months, and that is the non-politician, the amateur
Absolutely.
Politician, who the Donald Trump, what I call the Trump Carson factor, that. You know, is dominating everything that's going on in the Republican Party. And what you're seeing is a real appeal to disaffected Americans, many of whom became disaffected during the Great Recession. They lost their jobs, they had to take pay cuts, or somebody in the family did that. They're very unhappy with what's occurring overseas and national security threats. And they just see the country on a downward slide, and the demagogues, the ones who can shout the loudest and the longest, have suddenly risen to the fore, and are pulling all the presidential candidates very far to the right, very, very far to the right, and preaching a lot of un-American things, but it has emotional appeal in a time of fear and concern.
Well, when I look at that, at that outsider pull, that we don't want anybody who's ever been elected before to be elected now kind of thinking, I try to understand how that connects to the Freedom Caucus, or does it? Jeffrey, do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, is this essentially the same impulse in the party, or are these two different impulses in the party?
I think you're seeing very much the same dynamic, both within the Congress, particularly in the Freedom Caucus, as well as in the presidential race. And I do think it does go back to the Great Recession and the fact that a lot of the Republican Party's white, middle-aged base is faring extremely poorly. I'm sure you've seen the reports recently that this is the only group that experienced a downward trend in their mortality rates in recent years.
Right.
And the Freedom Caucus grew out of the Tea Party movement, which in many ways is a rebellion against the Republican Party and its establishment. And it very much distrusts government, even government turned toward conservative ends. It distrusts expertise, it distrusts political experience, and it's very much a populist, almost anarchic movement, which really strikes against a lot of the things the Republican Party has stood for. And there is very little capacity or capability on the part of party leaders to control this. There isn't a Ronald Reagan who can keep the conservative troops in line. There isn't a William F. Buckley Jr. who can marshal the intellectual arguments against this kind of anarchic populism. So the Republican Party really is looking at this point for some direction.
One of the ironies here, Sheila, and this was pointed out to me by my old boss at the Baltimore Sun, Joe Stern, is that the Republican Party's current problems can be traced to a large extent not only to the Great Recession, but to the loss by Mitt Romney to Barack Obama in the last presidential election, because he was the great hope of the Republican establishment, the mainstream Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He lost and walked away, essentially, from politics, and thus created a void, which was is being filled by the Tea Party faction, as well as the Trump Carson outsiders, because there is no strong establishment voice that has arisen as the GOP's national leader.
Laura, I think we may have interrupted you while you were still making your point about the elements.
Well, I mean, what I would add to some of this, although you didn't interrupt me, so you're all set. But I do think I'd broaden our current discussion a little bit more broadly than just the Tea Party and these voices. We've seen polling that looks at this anti-establishment feeling in the Republicans throughout the electorate. And we've seen polling that shows that most Republicans disapprove of their party leadership in Congress, which is unusual. And it's different from Democrats, who mostly approve of their party leadership in Congress. And, you know, so you see a difference between both party bases in that particular respect. I mean, I do think that I think everyone has brought up really excellent points about the recession and 2012. But I'd also like to add that I think we're going to see a very, you know, the long shadow of 2010. By which I mean a number of different things. I mean, this is a Tea Party election. Sure, there are a couple of Tea Party races in 2009, but it's mainly 2010. You have the redistricting that comes into place in a census year, and Republicans were able to capture an unusual number of state legislatures in that year. You have Citizens United, which is also 2010. I do think that there are a number of different aspects that have been structurally baked into the cake of American politics that we can trace back to that election, a wave election that is, I think, going to have consequences for years to come.
Okay, this is we need to take a break, and we've got a lot to think about now. We'd like for you to be part of this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 and tell us what your thoughts are about the Republican Party. Are you in it? Are you worried about it? Or do you think it's doing just fine and wonder why we're even talking about it on the air? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We're here with Laura Blessing, a senior fellow at the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown, Barry Raskovar, columnist for MarylandReporter.com, and Jeffrey Cabaservice, author of Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. We're talking politics, in particular the polarization of the National Republican Party. We're talking with Jeffrey Cabaservice, who is the author of From Rule to Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. Cabaservice is also research director for the Main Street Partnership, and a group of moderates in the House of Representatives. Also with us is Laura Blessing, senior fellow in Georgetown University's Government Affairs Institute, and Barry Raskovar, who blogs at politicalmaryland.com and is a columnist for MarylandReporter.com. As we left, Laura was pointing out to us some of the developments in 2010 and the changes and the impact that they may have. Jeffrey Cabaservice, let me ask you to reach further back into history and give us a sense of where the Tea Party comes from, what kind of roots it might have further back. Put the Tea Party in context for us.
Well, I think the Tea Party is an expression of populism, which is a phenomenon that you see recurring through American history, and it occurs on both the left and the right. And I would actually argue that we are approaching a more populist moment on the Democratic side as well as the Republican side. I think you're seeing that with the Black Lives Matter protests. I think you're seeing that with Bernie Sanders' candidacy as well. But going on the Republican side, I think what I've seen in history is a phenomenon where every 12 to 16 years you get a recurrence of a populist conservatism. It goes back to Joseph McCarthy and his anti-communist campaign in the early 1950s. It surfaces again with Barry Goldwater's 1964 presidential campaign. It surfaces again in the late 70s with Ronald Reagan's first challenge to Gerry Ford in 1976 and then his outright victory in the presidency in 1980. One more time with Newt Gingrich's 1994 takeover of the House and the contract with America, and now we're seeing it again with the Tea Party movement. And, you know, this happens very regularly when a lot of people at the base of the Republican Party, at the grassroots level, become discontented with their leadership because they don't feel that they're getting what they want through the political process, and that therefore it's necessary for them to kick out their leaders or hold them to account and energize the troops and take over. And like I said, we've seen this again and again through the party's history, but in American history as well.
Let me, if I can, pull in one of our callers who called us on 410-662-8780, as you can do too. This is Harry in Freeland, Maryland. Harry, welcome to Midday.
Hello, thank you.
You had a thought about where the Tea Party came from.
Yeah, my understanding is the Tea Party was a AstroTurf group funded by a few very rich people who basically were upset that the government was making rules. And so they got this AstroTurf group going, and it has achieved what they wanted. Sure, they're people they're attracting are living shorter and shorter lives and having less and less income, but that's of no concern to the Koch brothers and a few other rich people who funded it. They're getting what they want, and these other people have been lied to and gulled. That's my take on the Tea Party. I'd like to hear yours. I'll turn the radio back on.
So you don't think it's a populist movement?
I don't think it's a populist movement. I think it's a sham, and I think it is a really bad expression of what is basically fundamentally good values. I mean, I came from Arizona. I got to meet Barry Goldwater. I voted for him, so I go way back, and I have never seen anything like this.
Let me ask Jeffrey Cavaservice to comment on your comment. Jeffrey?
Well, you know, there's a sense in which the Tea Party movement is definitely supported by very deep-pocketed organizations from above. But on the other hand, I don't believe it's true that there are simply no supporters out there on the grassroots. They're there. I've met them. They exist. And indeed, they have a disproportionate impact on American life because most politics prior to presidential elections is really very low participation elections. The main reason that a group like the Tea Party is able to have such an impact on the Republican Party is that very few people turn out for Republican primaries. And that means a relatively small faction which is disciplined and, yes, supported by deep-pocketed organizations that are willing to give them money and support can have a disproportionate impact. And we've seen that in a number of elections, and I'd point in particular to Christine O'Donnell's overthrow of Mike Castle, the establishment's preferred nominee for the Senate
in Delaware.
Right. And this, you know, was enabled essentially because 15,000 people can turn up to the polls. That's not that many, really, for an election of such national consequence. So the Tea Party is not an enormous movement, but it's real, it does exist, and it's amplified because of the funding that it does receive from these outside groups.
Laura?
I think these are excellent points that he's making. To be sure, there are some very deep-pocketed funders for the Tea Party, but it is a very real movement. You also have, you know, there's a media component of people who regularly listen in to different right-wing media outlets that have that point of view as well. So it's not like these people don't have, you know, a community of interest. Something else I would add to what Jeffrey said is that you know, the Tea Party for a populist movement has explicit aims to enter government. It wants to work its will by electing people to Congress, and as such is different from other populist movements. Probably a good contrast you could make would be the Occupy Wall Street folks, remember them. it's been a little while. Certainly, they touched a nerve. Spent a fair amount of time in Zuccotti Park. You had a fair amount of, it seemed to be, sympathetic polling. But they shied away from too many particularly explicit political claims, for too many of them anyway. There was some talk of Glass-Steagall, but they also shied away from trying to win seats in Congress. So the Tea Party is unusual. It is different for that reason as well.
One of the things I find intriguing about the Tea Party movement is that it's almost Jeffersonian. The person who the Democrats look to as one of their founding fathers. But you're talking about what does the Tea Party want? Smaller or no government? States' rights, and a bit of libertarianism, that's where the Koch brothers come in. Let businesses do what they want, survival of the fittest, that type of attitude. But let every individual decide for themselves, their own path in life without government interference. Well, this is a lot of what Thomas Jefferson was aiming to do as well. So it's just an interesting aspect that the Tea Party is going so far right that it's almost coming out on the other side.
That's Barry Raskovar, a columnist with MarylandReporter.com here on Midday on WIPR. Also with us is Laura Blessing of Georgetown University and Jeffrey Cabaservice, Research Director for the Main Street Partnership, an organization of moderates in Congress. You can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Alan Greenblatt wrote a piece in Politico on Politico last month, basically making the point that the Freedom Caucus is, he said, unprecedented in that it's resisting its own leadership in the House, but it's not reaching across the aisle to form a coalition which might actually have enough votes to pass legislation. That's not what it's about. And he said that's never happened before. Jeffrey, is that as unusual in history as Politico made it out to be?
Yeah, Alan's a smart guy and a good political observer, and I think he's correct. You will have factions in the various parties, but rarely do they try to operate as a bloc against the leadership of their own party. And although this is probably too technical for the purposes of our discussion, what the Freedom Caucus is really doing is seeking to take its 40 votes not to pass legislation, but to prevent its own party leadership from undertaking procedural motions. And we really have not seen that before in history. Now, the members of the Freedom Caucus are among the least effective members of Congress. These are people who can't get a bill out of committee, let alone passed by a majority of the House. But they can, and so far seem to be, having some success in pulling the Republican Party further to the right. And what's, we have yet to see is whether Paul Ryan is going to abide by what we're told are the promises that he made to that group, including to abide by the Hastert rule, under which a speaker will not bring up a vote will not bring up a motion for a vote unless it has the support of the majority of the Republican Party. And that would actually prevent the Republican Party from passing a lot of the legislation that the leadership knows is in the best interest of the nation, such as Boehner's recent vote to raise the debt ceiling and fund the government.
So as you look ahead just for the next, say, few months, what is Paul Ryan's speakership going to mean? How is he going to function? Do you have a sense of that, or is it a big question mark?
I don't think people quite know where Paul Ryan is coming from yet, because we've seen him both a sort of unyielding conservative advocate of dismantling many aspects of government and also a fairly reasonable person who teamed with Patty Murray to get a good budget passed. So it's really going to depend on which of the factions wins Paul Ryan's soul, if you want to put it that way. And certainly the Main Street people are going to make their pitch for the Republican Party as a governing party that is a responsible party that deserves the support of the majority of the American people. and the House Freedom Caucus is going to make their pitch for the Republican Party as a revolutionary force, overthrowing government and overturning a lot of the established norms in American life.
I'm getting nods here in the studio. Laura, what do you want to add to that?
Well, and I think we're going to see Paul Ryan be tested very soon. With all due credit to John Boehner for cleaning out the barn, as he put it,
yeah.
And getting the Bipartisan Budget Act to raise us sequestration caps and extend the debt limit. It raised the sequestration caps. It did not actually pass a budget. So, you know, we're funded up through December 11th. We still need to put together a budget package. We're going to see Paul Ryan be tested very, very soon. And everything that played out over the course of the appropriations process, you know, what's left of it, is there's no reason that these same things can't play out as they try to get a budget together in the coming weeks.
You're saying this we'll see the same dynamic with Ryan that we saw with Boehner?
I'm saying that issues like Planned Parenthood haven't gone away, and they still need to pass an actual budget. They've just lifted the sequestration caps, mm-hmm. which gives them more money to play with mm-hmm. in a very important way that we should certainly give kudos to Boehner for. But that it didn't actually pass a budget. They still need to fund the government after December the 11th. So we're gonna see this clash come pretty soon.
I would like to get your other guests' comments on another point, which is puzzling to me. How does the Republican Senate play into this? Because a lot of people watching this from the public would say, "Well, you have a Republican House and a Republican Senate. Why can't they agree on something?" But most of the discussion we've had so far has been about the Republican House.
That's absolutely. Good point. And to that you would say, Laura?
That's a very interesting question. I was nodding my head vigorously, and so
I got to
answer it. To be sure, you have a bit of a different electoral base from the Senate than you do from the House. Which prompts a little bit more. I'm kind of struggling with saying the word moderate because the way that most political scientists anyway would measure moderates, you don't really have much of them in Congress in the Republican Party. But you have an ideologically more centrist group of Republicans in the Senate. You do not have a lot of coordination on things of interest to Paul Ryan, such as tax policy. You don't have a whole lot of coordination between the House Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee. That has been evidenced since during the 114th Congress. You've had Mitch McConnell kind of put his foot down on a number of different things over this year. I do think this is an issue to watch. The extent to which the Republican Party in each chamber can come together over time. I think that's a really interesting question.
Jeffrey, briefly before we take another break, what role do you see the Senate playing in this overall look we're taking at the party? Does the Senate pull it back to the middle?
I would agree that relatively few Republicans call themselves moderate nowadays. I think their preferred term is governing Republican, and they seek to use government affirmatively for conservative ends. And in that sense, they are very different from the Tea Party people. The Tea Party faction in the Senate is simply much smaller. It's probably 1.5 senators with Ted Cruz and sometimes Mike Lee. And that's because states you can't gerrymander a state, and typically senators have to represent all factions within the state, both agriculture and industry, both urban and rural areas, and even get votes from independents and even some Democrats if they hope to win re-election. And for that reason, the Senate is a much more considered body, shall I say, and experience and such virtues are still considered virtues in the Senate, which they're not so much in the House.
We're going to take another short break here. We've got a couple of callers with us, and I would urge them to hang on when we get back. I would like to sort of move away from Washington and talk some more about the campaign and how it is developing. We're going to be back with Barry Raskovar, who blogs at politicalmaryland.com, with Laura Blessing of Georgetown University, and with Jeffrey Cabaservice, Research Director for the Main Street Partnership, and with you, we hope. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're discussing politics with columnist Barry Raskovar. His columns appear in MarylandReporter.com, and he blogs at PoliticalMaryland.com. Jeffrey Cabaservice, author of From Rule to Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. Jeffrey is also research director for the Main Street Partnership on Capitol Hill. And Laura Blessing, senior fellow in the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University in Washington. We're talking about polarization in the Republican Party, and we're interested in what you think about it. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us 410-662-8780. And I want to go right now to Alex in Middle River, who made that phone call. Alex, welcome to Midday. Alex? Have we lost Alec? Or am I just not hearing Alec? Alec. Alec in Middle River.
Yes, I'm here.
Great. We'd love to hear what your comment is.
Well, I just wanted to actually have the guys there talk about what was going on with the Republican Party. You guys were talking about the Tea Party and the separations that have happened there. But another issue is that because of the upheaval in the Republican Party, you see a lot of historically Republican voters that are looking to the Democratic Party and obviously seeing something that they don't want to vote for that either, but they're going all the way left, and campaigns like Bernie Sanders are drawing lots of Republicans that are just tired of establishment politics, and they're willing to vote for a presidential candidate or a primary candidate that does not necessarily represent their views entirely, but that they believe represents the views of the public, and they're willing to go that way because they feel like they're going to get a more representative government that way.
Interesting thought. Who wants to pick it up? Jeffrey, I'm going to throw it at you, Jeffrey Cabaservice, because you're not – I can't see your face. I can't see whether you want to take this question or not.
Yes, I think you probably saw a quizzical expression on my face if I'd been in the studio. I don't foresee a huge movement of Republicans flocking to the Bernie Sanders campaign. But on the other hand, I do agree that he is tapping into many of the same frustrations and resentments that populists on the right are tapping, and that there's a desire – to get rid of all kinds of legislators and all kinds of traditional establishments of whatever variety. You know, what are you against? What do you got? I think that you hear that refrain on both the left and the right nowadays.
There have been several stories in major news organizations in the last 30 days or so about the word panic is used to describe what mainstream Republicans think about the Trump candidacy in particular, but also the Carson candidacy, in terms of fears by some Republicans that it would be really bad for the Republican Party if either of those outsiders become the nominee of the party. Partly, I think the point that you made earlier, Jeffrey, about the autopsy document, the plans of the mainstream party about how it could improve its performance from the last presidential campaign, how it could appeal more to non-white voters, et cetera, and how that just isn't happening and certainly wouldn't with, or it apparently would not, with Trump. So this leads to my question for any of you. If Trump gets the nomination, should we expect that the institutional Republican Party will support him, or will we see just a big What will we see in that case?
Well, I think that goes to my initial point. That's the great unanswered question. If not only if Trump is the nominee, but Ben Carson, the third person in the poll is Cruz, who is a Tea Party acolyte. And then you have Marco Rubio, who is very, very, you know, a lot of his views are very Tea Party-ish. These people are not part of the establishment, the Republican establishment whatsoever. So the question becomes, what do the mainstream Republicans, what I would call the pragmatic conservatives in the Republican Party, what do they do when they have a very doctrinaire, and rigidly ultra-conservative candidate running?
Can I leap in on that?
Please.
I think Trump is not a rigid, doctrinaire, ultra-orthodox conservative. He's a populist, and that's a large part of his appeal. He's able to say many things that traditional Republicans can't, about the need, for example, to tax billionaires and get rid of the carried interest deduction. And this is why he's very popular with the white working class, which, again, is still a large part of the Republican constituency. And I think, yes, the Republican Party will support Trump if he is the party's nominee. But the issue, to go back to your question about the autopsy document, is that Trump is doubling down on the strategy of maximizing the white vote. And Mitt Romney already won a greater percentage of the white vote in 2012 than Ronald Reagan did in 1980, and yet he lost because the demographics of the country are changing. And what worries the Republican strategists is that a Trump candidacy would mobilize Hispanics to vote against Trump and other Republicans, and that Trump would also get even fewer of the minority votes than Romney got in 2012. And so I think they see this as a risky strategy, and I think some of what you're seeing with, the kind of almost white nationalism around some of these campaigns is an expression of a direction the establishment would really rather not go.
But when you say really rather not go, how clear is it to you whether that means that Republicans will just sit on their hands and will they not show up at the polls, mainstream Republicans?
I think the mainstream Republicans could probably be persuaded to vote for Trump if he moves back towards the center. The question always, though, is how much credibility would a Trump have moving towards the more traditional Republican center after some of the positions that he's taken in the primaries? How credible would any Republican nominee be if the party goes too far to the right in these primary elections? And that's yet to be seen.
Laura, you had a point.
I do think that people have a hard time characterizing Trump on the political spectrum because there are so many atmospheric issues with him that make him look different. I do think that there's a strong populist element. But I'd like to point out that in many ways he's not, his stated positions are not so different. I mean, the immigration policy is quite, that rhetoric is quite extreme. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly something that the Republican Party as an organization is rightfully wary of. But in terms of things like his tax policy, as Kavasiewicz said, I'm not, you know, a lot of his rhetoric doesn't always match up to his policy. So he made a lot of statements before he released his tax plan, the policy details as they exist. And he said he made a lot of statements about, people like me are going to be paying more in taxes. And he then released his tax policy and that's not actually accurate. You know,
there's a cut for...
It's a pretty big cut for wealthy individuals. To be sure, it's cuts for everybody. And I think his cuts for lower-income people may be slightly larger than some of the other candidates. But it's actually pretty much right up the center of kind of classic Republican anti-tax views. To be sure, he makes a couple comments about how hedge fund managers don't pay a lot of taxes. You know, I imagine he probably knows more hedge fund managers than many of the other Republicans in the race. But his stated policy is not actually that different. I think the immigration business is a little bit different. It's also why I think people like Marco Rubio, having been a member of the Gang of Eight, are going to have a hard time hanging on in any way.
By the way, I should apologize to Jeffrey. I have been misstating the name of his book. It is Rule and Ruin, not what I've been saying. Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. We got an email from Bradley who wants to know what you all think about the, quote, the GOP's success at getting some people to vote against their best interests. I'm mainly thinking about folks in eastern Kentucky who recently overwhelmingly voted for a governor who is going to greatly reduce their he's written Medicare coverage. I think he means Medicaid coverage, which is the Medicaid is the program of health care for poor people, which many there need and use, Bradley writes. It seems the right is able to use issues like abortion and gay marriage to cloak the things they plan to cut. Comment from any of you on that?
I think that's a very astute point that he makes, that the Republican candidates are very, very good at sweeping generalizations, and in Kentucky it is quite quizzical as to why the poorer parts of that state voted for a Republican who vowed not only to cut back medical assistance, but to wipe out Obamacare. He's backed mm-hmm. away from that somewhat since then, but still, this is a Tea Party type of candidate who did remarkably well. But you see this in so many states that there's just general unhappiness with the direction of government that they take it out on the elected officials. And the outsider is the one that they support.
I would recommend that everyone go out and read the article by Baltimore native Alec McGillis in the New York Times called Who Turned My Blue State Red? He spent a lot of time in Appalachia with thinking about this very issue. And he found that people at the very bottom of the socioeconomic strata tend to be very supportive of government policies and programs like Obamacare, but they're not voting. It's the people who are just a cut above them, let's say in the second quintile from the bottom, who are voting Republican because they really don't like the way these disability programs and other things work. And they see this within their own families, and they see what they consider to be people who are taking advantage of government programs and other taxpayers, and that's why they're voting Republican.
Barry Raskovar, let me ask you what all of this we've been talking about tells us about Maryland's Governor Larry Hogan. We heard him join in the rhetoric against, for example, accepting refugees from Syria.
Yeah, well, Larry Hogan was elected basically because of the weakness of the Democratic candidate, but also because he came across as a nice guy and a presumed moderate or practical conservative. His first year in office has shown him to be a lot more conservative than people imagine. And he does tend to swing toward the national Republican rhetoric on a number of issues, and now he's done it on the refugee question in Maryland. And you know, it's just an unknown as to how Hogan is going to plot his future, whether he's going to side with the more extreme voices in the Republican Party, or is he going to be sort of a Chris Christie acolyte, which you know, Christie has been a big supporter of Hogan.
Okay, we'll check back on that. I want to thank you all for a really interesting hour. Thank you. Laura Blessing, Senior Fellow in the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University. Barry Raskovar, columnist for MarylandReporter.com. Jeffrey Cabaservice, author of Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. And we'd like to thank you for listening. We're back on Friday when we'll discuss holiday shopping and how urban farms keep themselves busy in the winter. We'll also talk to a muralist creating work in Sandtown, Winchester. Hope you'll be with us for that. But meanwhile, have a safe and wonderful Thanksgiving. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Droneberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.